We're discussing lung health this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Wildfire season out west and in Canada is far from over, and we felt the effects in our state with our air quality index shooting up into the yellow, orange, red recently in some parts of the state. What do you want to know about air quality from pollution and your ability to breathe? Do you manage asthma or COPD? What are your questions to improve lung function? It's 800-642-1234. Sarah Brundage is president of the Wisconsin Society for Respiratory Care. She's senior program manager at Propeller Health. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Let's start with those wildfires currently burning. As we see the wave of smoke going across the U.S., here in Wisconsin as well, as it drifts for miles and miles, how damaging is it to our lungs?
It all depends on your proximity, obviously, to the pollutant that is being spread across the U.S. Even down here in Madison, you can see that the air is a little bit hazier, but I have family in northern Wisconsin, and it's a lot hazier, more impacted up there. And anytime you're not breathing in really clean air, it's not good for our lungs.
Yeah, and that smoke, it contains a blend of superfine particles. What can that do to the lungs?
Sure. They're super fine, which means really small. The smaller the particle, the deeper they can get into your lungs. And the deeper parts of our lungs are often the most fragile. So anything that gets in there can start to cause some issues, irritation. If you don't have a pre-existing lung condition, you might start to feel like a cough, or you might start to develop like mucus production or nasal drip. But if you've got lung disease or you're a kiddo who has developing lungs, you might feel the symptoms much more immediately.
Yeah, what effects might it have on children whose lungs are developing?
Sure, they've got smaller lungs and they're fragile because they are developing. So they'll exhibit symptoms much quicker than an adult with no lung disease. So you'll just want to be mindful. We really recommend that you pay attention to your air quality index. So on really bad days, stay indoors. You can even run your AC. Sometimes that's really helpful for filtering out those things, but just be mindful of not really playing outside or having practices outside.
Yeah. What can that air quality index measure? What does it tell us?
Sure. It's maintained by the EPA, and it actually measures five major air pollutants, one of them being ground-level ozone, which we know is increasing with climate change. But it also looks at that particle pollution, which comes with wildfires. It looks at carbon monoxide, also a byproduct of burning or wildfires, and then sulfur dioxide and nitrogen dioxide. So you already mentioned it, there's a color scale. Pretty much anything that goes yellow, orange, red, or purple, which is really, really bad, you're really going to start to see effects. And the gradient goes, the lighter the color, people with lung disease will probably show symptoms, but as it gets into those deeper colors, people without lung issues are going to start to have symptoms.
And that AQI can change throughout the day.
It can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All
based on weather. Yeah, we're talking with Sarah Brundage, who's president of the Wisconsin Society for Respiratory Care. She's fielding your questions on lung health. Do you have concerns about air quality from wildfire smoke? Do you see a respiratory therapist? What's been your experience? 800-642-1234 to join in. Let's go to Tom in Burlington. Hi, Tom. What's your question?
Well, I want to say this. My neighbor went to the hospital about 3 days ago. We're here in Burlington. We're in the southeast part of the state, and we've had an air quality alert for the last 3 or 4 days. And then he got all panicked because his eyes were watering and his nose was running. And he went to the hospital, and then he came back, and I said, "Well, didn't you realize we've had this air quality thing?" And he said, "No, we didn't." But that's, it turns out that's all it was in his problem, thank goodness. But my question is, what is the correct way of breathing? There are shallow chest breathers and there are full belly breathers. And I wonder if you might explain to people that diaphragm between your belly and your in your lungs is very misleading, because when you push your lungs out, that pulls the diaphragm up, and you're not actually getting the full amount of air into your lungs. And another thing we do with our kids, we put diapers around their bellies, and if you watch a child when they breathe, his belly goes up and down, and we put these tight diapers around him, and then the kid can't breathe. So I just wonder if you might explain that.
Tommy, you bring up a lot of important points here. Sarah, go ahead.
Sure. So there's definitely the differences between belly breathing and breathing in your upper chest. Historically, women have breathed a little bit shallower. A lot of that has to do with societal norms and pressures on maintaining a small waist. If you watch men breathe, they tend to breathe with their diaphragm and with their belly more, which is the most efficient, true, correct way to breathe. You also see this in professional singers. Instead of them taking a quick breath in and maybe their shoulders moving up, which is a shallow breath, you'll see their belly moves out. And that's truly the diaphragm pulling down and allowing more room for your lungs to fully expand. We do lung testing, and we see with people who wear really tight clothing, it might kind of unconsciously prompt them to not take those nice deep breaths. They might breathe a little bit more up into their chest. Diapers, for the most part, usually they ride a little bit lower and maybe aren't super tight. So kiddos are natural belly breathers as well. So we don't see a huge amount of issues. When I'm coaching people to learn how to belly breathe, the easiest thing is if you're laying in bed and you put your hand on your tummy or your abdomen, and you take a nice slow breath in through your nose and just try to slowly move your belly out as you breathe in. And slowly that'll become more of a natural rhythm for you if you are an upper chest breather.
Whether you're on your back or whether you're standing or sitting. I wonder, you know, what impact does posture have on how big a breath you can take?
A lot. Our rib cage really kind of determines also how big we can breathe. There's a lot of conditions that affect the stiffness of your ribs. And then if you've got poor posture, like maybe you're a hunter, that also makes your chest cavity smaller and will thereby make your breathing also smaller. Although if you look at sprinters, you know, after they've just done a race and a sprint, they kind of double over, hands on their legs, and they're trying to take a big deep breath in. That's called splinting. And what is happening is all the little muscles within your ribs are trying to help open up the rib cage a little bit more to help you take those nice big deep breaths. And splinting just kind of helps do that.
Well, let's go to Chris now in Milwaukee. Chris, hi.
Hi. My question is about southeastern Wisconsin. I have understood that we are allowed more pollution than other parts of the country, that our air quality is always worse and they don't tell us about it, and that they blame Chicago so Chicago can pollute us so we can pollute ourselves. And I would really like to know if we are under the same kinds of codes as everybody else. I'll listen off the air. Thanks.
Chris, thank you. I don't think this falls within respiratory therapist territory, but go ahead, Sarah.
Sure. So I did used to work for a large national nonprofit that helped monitor air quality. And yes, South Central Wisconsin does have high levels of air pollution. We do subscribe to national standards, and then we've even got our own state standards. Where we see the higher rates of air pollution are like Racine and Kenosha County, also up in Sheboygan. A lot of that has to do with the industry that's in those areas. And then Chicago is a part of it. You know, the Great Lakes create an air current, and it does carry up some of their own industrial pollution up through our counties and our communities that rest along the Great Lake border.
Yeah, that lake effect. Yeah.
Yes.
registered respiratory therapist Sarah Brundage is fielding your questions about lung function in COVID. She's been caring for patients who have difficulty breathing. Are you working with a respiratory therapist now? What exercises have helped you improve your breathing? What questions do you have about the latest developments and techniques to improve lung function? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Sarah Brundage in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're discussing lung health on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The CDC says people who have heart or lung diseases, COPD or asthma, are at higher risk from wildfire smoke. Children are more likely to be affected by health threats from the smoke, older adults as well. What questions do you have about respiratory care? How do you take care of your lungs? What do you want to know about masking up and about protection from tiny particles? Be part of this. 800-642-1234. Sarah Brundage is a registered respiratory therapist with us for the hour. Let's bring in Ralph now in Lone Rock. Hi, Ralph. What would you like to ask?
Yes, I'd like to ask Sarah if there are exercises that you can do to increase your lung capacity. I've recently had some issues with my lungs where I'm told that I would probably lose 10 to 15% of my capacity. I'm like 70 years old, and I would like to know if there's anything that I can do after these treatments to enhance my breathing or expand my lung capacity. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, Ralph, thank you. Sarah.
Yeah, Ralph, first I recommend obviously talking with your care team because I don't know your history. I can't get too specific, but if you just practice overall health activity and exercise, that's going to be a huge benefit. Any sort of movement that you can get going, even if it's just taking small hand weights and doing some arm exercises, or it's taking walks around the block, getting your body up and moving is super, super beneficial for not only your lungs, but overall health. And then if you want to practice that belly breathing that I mentioned earlier, you can also look it up. If you just Google belly breathing, there's plenty of videos that can teach you how to do that, and that'll help with making sure you're getting the biggest, most efficient breath that you can.
If we do sprints or some really rigorous exercise that, of course, brings up our heart rate and causes us to breathe really fast, what impact does that have?
That's our body's natural tendency to breathe faster if we're exercising and moving, because our muscles are utilizing oxygen, and so the only way we can get oxygen is if we pull in more air or if we pull it in faster. So it has no real detriment. It's good. The more you exercise, your cardiovascular and your pulmonary stamina will also increase.
You've been working in the UW Health Trauma and Life Support Center in the pandemic. What are you seeing in the patients that you're treating?
You know, you see it all over the news. It's heart-wrenching for those of us who have to care for these patients. It's difficult. They're a tough subset of patients because we haven't seen how their body reacts really before like this, and how quickly they can progress and get very, very sick. Obviously, myself and all my colleagues work very, very hard at helping them get better, rest, and hopefully get out of the hospital.
Can you walk us through some of the respiratory issues that you might see and how you would address them with COVID patients?
Sure. It all falls on a spectrum. It can be anywhere from, you know, just standard cold symptoms. Usually we don't see them in the hospital. When we see them, it's usually because they're having substantial issues with breathing. We treat those with regular respiratory medications like albuterol or some inhaled corticosteroids, which is pretty standard for anybody who ends up having to come in for respiratory issues. if people get worse and worse and maybe their body needs to rest or have more time for their lungs to kind of heal, they might end up on a ventilator or a breathing machine. And if it really progresses, they might end up on something called ECMO, which is almost like it's a big heart and lung bypass machine.
What do the x-rays of these patients look like? What are you seeing?
Sure. X-rays can tell us a couple of things, but usually a healthy set of lungs is going to look pretty much black. And that means that, you know, there's good air movement, there's no irritation or inflammation going on. But with a lot of our COVID patients, we're seeing their lungs whited out. And white means that the x-rays can't really get through the tissue. So that means something's blocking it, whether there's inflammation in the tissue or there's excess mucus production, or in really severe cases, there's something called fibrosis, which is scarring within the lung tissue.
When a patient is on a ventilator, what are you watching for, and what is your role as a respiratory therapist?
Sure. Our role is to obviously maintain the respiratory status of the patient, and that includes monitoring all sorts of different blood and lab levels. We need to make sure that every organ, every tissue in the body is getting enough oxygen so that it can properly function and try to help repair itself. Because while we're really advanced in the medical field, we can't take care of everything with medicine, and our body truly needs to have its time. So we try to give it all the resources it can and as much oxygen as we can get it.
What is the impact of a prolonged stay on a ventilator, patients who are on a ventilator for quite some time?
Yeah, there's something called ventilator-induced lung injury, and our lungs don't like having air pushed into them. So that's not natural to our body. Our lung tissue is very fragile. So even being on a ventilator, you know, for a week, you can see some lasting effects or irritation and inflammation. I keep saying over and over, lung tissue is so fragile, but I don't think we think about it because it's inside our body. We can't see it. So it is really important that you take care of your health. You try to stay away from COVID exposures so that we aren't having to do these really drastic measures that can lead to injury.
On a more personal note, on working on the floor, on the Trauma Life and Support Center, how do you take care of yourself and get through of just seeing very difficult situations with your patients?
The healthcare team truly is a family. Just knowing that you have people there to back you, we're all there to support each other and help each other through all of the tough work that's going on. And then just, I love getting outside in nature when you can. Obviously right now with the wildfire stuff, be aware of that, but getting out, getting my body moving, and that helps me disconnect and reset.
We're talking with Sarah Brundage, who's president of the Wisconsin Society for Respiratory Care. She's taking your questions about lung function, challenges in respiratory health, 800-642-1234. Sarah, we've heard about long haulers. How do you help patients rebuild their lung health after COVID, especially if problems persist?
So I personally don't work with long haulers patients. I do have a couple of friends that have long haulers, and there's more and more clinics popping up to address patients who are exhibiting long haulers condition. And for those that don't know, long haulers is COVID symptoms that last for a really, really long time, even a year plus. You might have ebbs and flows of feeling good and then all of a sudden feeling bad again. We really encourage those people to, again, adjust their diet, try to exercise, but also try to balance your rest. It's a really, really tricky situation. And we encourage people who are experiencing that to seek out, a professional or visit a long haulers clinic.
What does rest do for the lungs in particular?
So it allows your body uses oxygen to do everything. So if you allow the rest of your body to kind of chill out, rest, not have to consume that oxygen, then that's all the more. Our body's very smart, and it can direct whatever resources it needs to the areas that need help. So if you're resting and your lungs need a little bit more help, then our body is naturally going to send blood flow and resources to that area to help repair it. So establishing your own health through exercise, but also rest, is very, very beneficial.
Respiratory therapist Sarah Brundage with us leads the Wisconsin Society for Respiratory Care. Have your asthma attacks or breathing problems worsened over time? What triggers them or causes your symptoms to worsen? Have you had new lung issues due to coming down with COVID? What is that like? Join in any point, 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this with Sarah Brundage after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour on lung health on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The lungs, they're a major target of COVID-19. And when the virus is inhaled into the lungs, it invades the tissues, causing inflammation and breathing problems. The American Lung Association says if the infection gets worse, it can develop into pneumonia. And in severe cases, patients may develop acute respiratory distress syndrome, causing low blood oxygen. Are you a COVID long hauler with unresolved issues with your lung capacity? What do you want to ask the respiratory therapist? Join in 800-642-1234. Sarah Brundage is with Propeller Health, and she's been caring for COVID patients during this health crisis. Stays with us. Let's go to Mark now in De Pere. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if there's a better time of the day to get out and get aerobic exercise outside when there is this smoky condition from wildfires, such as, is it better to exercise in the morning?
In the morning, the afternoon, evening. Sarah?
That's really tricky. It's, again, all dependent on the weather and also the kind of the thickness of the particle pollution. But typically in the morning, can be better just because ozone levels tend to be a little bit lower. So then you're taking away that thing that can also affect your lungs. It also tends to be a little bit cooler. So heat can cause more issues with particle pollution, as well as just humidity and making breathing a little bit more difficult. So try to go when it's a little bit cooler and maybe not quite as windy.
Mark, have you noticed differences as you try to exercise with the pollution and in these conditions?
I don't know that like you say, that it's all about the particles. I mean, if I do it after a rain shower, obviously it's going to be much easier to breathe, I notice, for instance, as opposed to right before it rains. Oftentimes, if I'm late in the afternoon, it seems like it's not as, I don't know.
Yeah.
Actually, I notice it more with my eyes being irritated by it than my lungs at times. But you're right. It's about the particles. It all depends on which way the wind is blowing sometimes.
Sarah, go ahead, Sarah.
And after the rain, you're exactly right. The rain helps keep dust and particles down. So we see that even in construction zones, if they spray down for dust, that helps with lung issues. And our eyes are also very sensitive, and they're like a mucous membrane as well. So if you're getting things in your eyes are going to be itchy. They're also going to probably water more. Your body wants to try and lubricate and get that gunk out of there.
Yeah, our eyes are a good indication of what our lungs might be feeling as well. Mark, thanks for the call. I want to turn to asthma and get your insights on, well, first of all, explain what asthma is and then what you're experiencing in the profession as you treat asthma.
Yeah. Asthma is an obstructive disease. So it's in the same class of diseases as COPD or emphysema. It's a little bit more transient, though, which just means every patient is a little bit different. They have their own triggers and kind of the things that go into it. But I like to break asthma down into three different things. There's the squeeze, or there's little muscles around our airways that when they get irritated by something you breathe in, they're going to constrict and kind of tighten. And then there's also inflammation or swelling. So again, lungs are very fragile. Anything that gets into them and can irritate them cause the tissue to start swelling. And then the other part is mucus. So again, our body loves to lubricate and get rid of and try and trap anything that's not supposed to be there. And so our body will start to create mucus. So those three things all lead to an asthmatic having difficulty breathing.
And there's been updated guidance on treating asthma. What are some of the new approaches, or where is medicine headed on asthma?
Historically, and I mean, even in pop culture, you would see asthmatics with an albuterol inhaler. Albuterol is that quick rescue medication. But there's been greater emphasis on inhaled corticosteroids or a controller medication. And part of that is because we're finding out more and more albuterol only works on that squeeze component, and that can go away very quickly. The part that's most concerning is that inflammation and swelling, and it takes time to go away. And that's what the inhaled corticosteroids work on. And it takes time. You have to continue to take that controller medication for days and every single day to see the benefit. And that's where patients really tend to struggle.
And this is personal. I understand that you manage asthma for yourself as well.
I do. I do have asthma. I was first diagnosed in high school when I was running cross country and wasn't quite as fast as everybody else. But once we got the diagnosis and myself on the proper medication, I did much, much better.
Has your asthma changed at all over the years?
For me, I would say I have better control of it. I mean, I am a respiratory therapist, so I know what I'm supposed to be doing and when I'm supposed to be taking my medications. But I've also paid attention to what my triggers are. And everybody's triggers are different. I tend to struggle on really high, humid days, but don't have issues in the winter. There's people who have the exact opposite. I also struggle with strong smells. So if people wear perfume, burn candles, maybe even grass cutting, that's a really strong smell. So people need to kind of start to pay attention to what is causing them to have triggers, or maybe what they came into contact with before they started feeling sick.
Does it develop differently in girls versus boys?
It does. So when girls are born, they tend to have this hormone in their body at higher levels than little boys. So our lungs are a little bit more developed. But then as little boys grow and they go through puberty and they get testosterone and their airways grow, a lot of times if they had issues with asthma, the issues might become a bit less after puberty. You never really grow out of or get rid of asthma, but the impact might be less. The opposite happens for girls. So at the start, we're kind of protected. But then once we go through puberty and we've got estrogen and progesterone and a couple other hormones going through our body, we end up having greater upticks in asthma once we go through that. And you can see that in pregnancy, the first and third trimester of pregnancy. Women may show asthma symptoms, and that all has to do with hormones. And same with a woman's monthly cycle, you'll see asthma increases.
We're talking with Sarah Brundage, who's president of the Wisconsin Society for Respiratory Care, as we discuss lung health in the pandemic, in wildfire season. You can join in at any point. What questions do you have about respiratory care? Maybe you have asthma or COPD. How are you managing it? Have you seen a respiratory therapist? 800-642-1234. Jean is joining us from Menominee. Hi, Jean. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I have a question regarding increased frequency of pulmonary issues among workers that have been using primary irritant disinfectants for cleaning surfaces in hospitals, such as peroxyacetic acid and that. Have you seen any of that incidence of disease among employees in hospitals?
I can't say specifically, but we do know that workforce or occupational exposures play a huge role in whether you develop lung issues later in life, or maybe you have more immediate acute symptoms. You know, I was just talking about triggers. Usually when I work with families, I teach them to not spray any sort of cleaning products in their home because you're aerosolizing or you're getting those chemicals up in the air and it's much easier for you to breathe them in. We teach them to pour it onto a cloth and then do their cleaning. And the same thing, you know, those chemicals that we use in hospitals to disinfect and fungicides and all sorts of things are really harsh, and they are hard on our lungs. They're classified as an irritant. So even if you don't have underlying lung issues, irritants can really affect your lungs too. So yeah, definitely workplace and occupational exposures are a very real thing.
Well, this naturally then goes to masking. What do masks do as you look at these different irritants, whether it's air pollution or COVID-19?
It really depends on the mask that you're using. Every mask has its own kind of standard filtration classification. So a standard cloth mask or dust mask is only going to really filter out really large particles. Then as you get into your N95s and things like that, smaller and smaller particles are filtered and not allowed in. And then as you see with, you know, firefighters and things like that, they wear full-blown respirators, and those really filter out nearly everything. So it's a continuum, and it can be kind of tricky.
Yeah, so you really have to pay attention to the information on that mask as to, you know, what you're trying to accomplish with it.
Yep.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about COPD and what you see there in terms of treatment and just what this disease is, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
It historically has been looked at the older white man's disease. We used to see it in men in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and a lot of that did have to do with occupational exposures or smoking rates. The number one cause of COPD is smoking and tobacco consumption. But we are starting to see it in younger and younger populations and much more in women now. And a lot of that can be tied to things like vaping, marijuana use, again, occupational exposures. But it is really interesting to kind of see the development of how it's really expanding outside of that initial group of older men.
We are talking with respiratory therapist Sarah Brundage, who has been helping patients breathe as she is with Propeller Health, a digital health company focused on managing chronic respiratory disease. Still time to talk about your lung issues. Are you receiving cardiopulmonary care? How is your therapy progressing? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Sarah Brundage here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Respiratory therapists, they care for patients who have trouble breathing, like from chronic respiratory disease like asthma or emphysema. COVID-19, it can cause lasting lung damage, and the medical community continues to learn more about how it affects the lungs during acute illness and afterward with long haulers. Sarah Brundage is a licensed respiratory therapist, has been working with COVID patients on lung function, and is fielding your questions for about 9 more minutes. Rob is with us from Madison. Hi, Rob.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
So I have mild asthma, and my daughter also has mild asthma. And we've noticed that it seems like our symptoms are a bit worse when we're at home than when we're in other places. And I was just wondering, should we look at things like duct cleaning services, or should we be buying like some of those like home kind of air purifiers, or how much, what's the role of dust, or is it really more like the cleaning chemicals and these other triggers that you've been talking about so far that we should be more concerned about?
Yeah, I recommend if you go to the American Lung Association's website, it's ALA.org, they have a checklist of things you can check in your home to see if maybe it's an asthma trigger. When I used to do home assessments for asthmatics, and the biggest thing that I would run into is if the home has carpet, that harbors dust and dust mites can have a huge role in asthma symptoms. The other thing is on your mattress, do you have a dust mite mattress cover? Those are usually not very expensive. And same with your pillows. You want to have a dust mite cover for your pillows. Those, because you're breathing in and you have your face in your pillow for multiple hours during the day. The other thing to think about is take a shower before bed. That way you're not bringing in all the pollen and the dirt and the things from outside, and then resting in it on your pillow and breathing that in all night. But I really recommend checking out that checklist. It's super helpful, and it can break down some typical triggers that you might find in different areas of your home.
Rob, do those tips help?
Yeah, that helps a lot. I just did want to know that with the, I mean, specifically the other thing I was just curious about is it worthwhile to look at things like duct cleaning? Is that usually the thing, though? By the way, thank you for everything you said there. Those were not things I was thinking of at all, and I will definitely do those things.
Yeah, I get asked about the duct cleaning quite a bit, and honestly, no, there's not a huge amount of things that happen to be in the duct unless you happen to look in like your floor grate and you truly see like a big accumulation of dust. It's not going to be beneficial. But again, check your furnace filter. Maybe you need to get a thicker filter or change it more often as well.
Certainly, amid COVID, people have been buying these air filters. I'm looking at one right now here in the studio that stands on the floor in the corner. What impact does that have?
Yeah, you want to make sure that you're looking at the specifications of an air filter. So if you've got like one of the standing ones, look up and make sure that they don't create ozone. Hmm. So a lot of air filters and air purifiers create ozone as a byproduct. While that ozone can kill bacteria and things, it also is a major lung irritant. So just make sure you're double checking that it does not produce that.
You mentioned earlier when you were talking about COPD that the impact of marijuana use, are there effects on the lung, on lung health from marijuana?
Yeah, anytime you're not breathing in clean air, it's going to be a detriment to your lung health overall. And it's going to irritate things. And when you have chronic irritation, that leads to lasting lung issues ultimately.
How about vaping? What effects would vaping have on the lungs?
Vaping is causing something that we see named bronchiolitis obliterans. So it literally deteriorates lung tissue. In vaping, the little like juices that they call them, there's flavorings, there's colorings, and there's chemicals like formaldehyde and acrolein, and there's even nicotine in some. And they end up causing some substantial damage to our lung tissue. And there's even studies and evidence out there that if somebody starts vaping young, it also leads to an increased risk of using cigarettes later on. So you're kind of compounding and creating these bad habits that will just end up speeding up lung issues.
Is there any sense that if the vaping happens for a short period of time, that there are lingering problems with the lungs that could go on for quite some time?
So everybody's body reacts a little bit differently. Some people can use for a while and really not see effects. Historically, when you're smoking, whether it's marijuana, vaping, cigarettes, hookah, it can take some time to do damage to your lungs. And it's at a rate that we don't really register or we're not able to experience until it's at a point that it's so bad that it's really causing symptoms. And once you're starting to experience symptoms, it's at a critical point of where you're going to end up needing some additional intervention.
Are there new interventions in caring for COPD with these patients?
So just like with asthma, COPD, we heavily use inhaled corticosteroids. So with COPD, their main issue is they don't really have that squeeze effect that happens in asthma, but they've got the really substantial inflammation, which ends up harming your lung tissue. So we just really focus on the inhaled corticosteroids to keep that inflammation down and to make sure that their lungs stay as healthy as possible.
Let's bring in Jackie in Milwaukee now. Hi, Jackie.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to ask?
I just had a question. I'm trying to find out if how you know if you have asthma, because outside with this, even if there's a little bit of smoke, and the smoke is every day, I have a really hard time breathing. It'll feel like my bronchial tubes are scorched. And like my husband who's got bronchitis is fine. And I'm watching people jog and run, and I'm like, what the heck? How, you know, I was never diagnosed with asthma. So who do you go to find out if you have asthma?
Yeah, a great place to start is just with your GP or your general primary doctor. They'll do a physical assessment. So obviously the things of listening to you, but then they'll probably send you to what's called a pulmonary function lab. And you end up, there's a machine that you end up doing these different breathing moves in, and they can tell if you have asthma or not by doing that. So start with your doctor, talk to him about your symptoms, and then he or she will determine whether or not you should go get the actual function testing.
Yeah, Jackie, thanks for that. Sarah, we have only a few moments left, but looking at your field, what challenges are you and other respiratory therapists facing?
I think right now it is a high level of burnout, and that's compounded by the fact that there's a huge shortage of respiratory therapists. And so, you know, we try to stay as upbeat as possible, and, you know, new students and people are entering the profession all the time, which is very, very exciting. But we just really want to ask that everybody be mindful, care for each other, and hopefully we don't have to care for you.
Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Sarah Brundage is president of the Wisconsin Society for Respiratory Care. She's senior program manager for Propeller Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.